Welcome to the Right Take Podcast, news, ideas, and conversations at the intersection of politics and culture, a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. I will be your host, Mark Tapson. Greetings and welcome back to the Right Take Podcast. I am your host, Mark Tapson. Over the past several decades, few places in America have become more hostile to free speech than our universities, our so-called institutions of higher learning, which, as we all know, have been largely ideologically captured by the radical left. Yet, university administrators seem to have no problem with the rising anti-Semitism and pro-Hamas rallies and campus occupations in the wake of that terror group's October 7th attacks in Israel. The David Horowitz Freedom Center has exposed the most egregious perpetrators of these double standards of free speech in a new booklet on sale at the frontpagemag.com store. As many of you know, we've put out many, many important booklets like this, short reads on critical topics in politics and culture. They sell for maybe $1 to $3. And our latest booklet is called Ivory Tower Hypocrites. In it, we profile the top 10 universities whose leaders have permitted woke activists to run roughshod over campus rules and violate codes of conduct with impunity, all the while failing to extend even basic free speech protections to students and faculty with opposing views, i.e., conservative views. Georgetown University is number 4 on our list. In the months after Hamas's barbaric October 7th massacre in Israel, Georgetown, located in our nation's capital, played host to many vitriolic anti-Semitic events and demonstrations led by both students and faculty, and calling for the genocide of Jews and the continuation of terror violence against Israel. My guest at the Right Take today happens to be a Georgetown law professor, or I should say former Georgetown law professor, whose personal story of ideological persecution there is an eye-opening one and a cautionary tale for all right-leaning academics, students, and people in the legal field more generally speaking. We're going to talk about that today and about the state of higher education in the Trump era, in which diversity, equity, and inclusion, or DEI programs, are being rolled back. So stay tuned. You don't want to miss this conversation. And don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take, if you haven't already, so that you do not miss any of the compelling conversations we're having here. Don't touch that dial. My guest today at the intersection of politics and culture is a senior fellow and director of constitutional studies at the Manhattan Institute. He was previously executive director at the Georgetown Center for the Constitution, and before that, a vice president of the Cato Institute. He's contributed to publications ranging from the Wall Street Journal to the Washington Post, and is the author of, most recently, Lawless, The Miseducation of America's Elites, which I'm currently reading, by the way, and Supreme Disorder, Judicial Nominations and the Politics of America's Highest Court. Ilya Shapiro, welcome to the Right Take Podcast.
Great to be with you.
Thanks for coming on. Ilya, you were set upon by the cancel culture crowd after posting a rather innocuous tweet, which somehow turned controversial and triggered this online mob and also triggered Georgetown University administrators who were your new employer at the time. Could you set that up for us with some background about yourself and your time at Georgetown?
Yeah. So I had been at the Cato Institute, a libertarian think tank, for nearly 15 years, and had the opportunity to change my career trajectory. I got an offer to be the executive director of Georgetown's Center for the Constitution, which Professor Randy Barnett founded. And we were having dinner one night, and things clicked, and it was a great opportunity to have a different kind of impact, both teach and also have a university position, a little different than being at a think tank. A few days before I was due to start that job, in January of 2022, was when Justice Breyer announced his retirement. And I'm a Supreme Court watcher. My last book, Supreme Disorder, is about the politics of judicial nominations. So whenever something like this happens, this is in my wheelhouse. I'm doing media all day. I'm commenting as I was that day. And then I got home, or I got to my hotel room. I was on the road in Austin, Texas. And I was seeing all this commentary online that President Biden was going to keep to his campaign promise from 2020 to appoint a black woman to the Supreme Court. Nothing wrong with appointing a black woman to the Supreme Court, of course. But I thought, well, you know, he should appoint whoever he thinks the best person is, regardless of their sex and race. And I tweeted out to that effect, a hot take, if you will. I said, if I was a Democratic president, I would pick the chief judge of the D.C. Circuit. Very well-respected man. Happens to be an Indian-American immigrant as well, so there's some demographic flavoring. But I said, given today's hierarchy of intersectionality, he was disqualified, and we would end up with a, quote, lesser black woman. And then I went to bed. And overnight, this exploded. My ideological enemies seized on not the best phrasing. I would have phrased it a different way if it wasn't on Twitter, if it wasn't late at night, what have you. It wasn't clear. There was 4 days of hell whether my contract would be rescinded, whether I'd be able to start my job. I could feel my career crumbling before my eyes. Ultimately, I was onboarded but immediately suspended, and there proceeded a four-month investigation, 4 months of purgatory into whether I was violating university harassment and anti-discrimination policies, at the end of which they reinstated me on the technicality that I wasn't quite employed by Georgetown when I tweeted, so I wasn't subject to those policies. But it was a weird, crazy time, and I realized that even though I'd been reinstated, I couldn't do the job I was hired to do, that I'd be back. I got this report from the DEI office that any time I said something that offended somebody, that would put me back in the Inquisition. And so I quit, and I made a loud exit, as lawyers say, publishing my resignation letter in the Wall Street Journal, announcing my next move on Fox News, and have been using this platform that I didn't ask for but that I've been given to shine a light on the rot in academia.
And what's interesting is that four-month investigation was something that probably could have been resolved in literally an hour. But as I think you noted in the book, that the process is the punishment, right?
That's right. I mean, this is happening at a law school. Their speech and expression policy is very short. Their harassment policy, their anti-discrimination policy, all these things are not complicated. I mean, maybe they should be written better or what have you, but these are not long, complicated documents. So, and my tweet, of course, is even shorter. So, you know, you could have assigned the most junior law professor to apply the law, apply these policies to the facts, and have your answer, in less than an hour. But no, it took 4 months, they spent a lot of money. They hired Wilmer Hale, which is one of the most elite, most expensive D.C. law firms, to advise them. And I guess a junior associate at some point looked at the calendar and realized I wasn't I wasn't employed, and so there was a jurisdictional defect. That's why I said, you know, even though initially I was taking the investigation seriously, you know, making a statement and having a Zoom with the inquisitors, but very quickly to my lawyer and I, it became clear that that this was a farce, I re-entered the public arena and kept commenting on things until it was all resolved.
And part of dragging out that process, that investigation, was also, would you say it was also to sort of send a message to other academics, you know, to encourage the others, as the saying goes, to sort of send the message that we're going to drag you through this same kind of gauntlet if you aren't more careful about your ideological comments?
I think that's absolutely right, and the way that the resolution happened as well, the dean started requiring more diversity training for administrators, a whole host of other things. The report that I got from the DEI office made clear it wasn't just about me. You know, anytime, despite the clear language in their free speech and expression policy that merely causing offense is not actionable, it made clear that indeed, if you don't want to be dragged through this thing, you'll keep your head down. And the process was the punishment, in the sense that, you know, their employment lawyers correctly advised them to keep paying me through all of this. So this was a paid leave, but you know, my reputation was sullied. I couldn't do the work. I was in a weird psychological position. The way these things should work is the dean should have said off the bat, you know, that was poor communication, and I disagree, or, you know, if he disagreed with my underlying point, that's fine, but You know, there's no evidence that he did anything other than speak, and therefore there cannot be any discipline. And that would have been the end of it. But no, it all dragged out.
It seems to me there's no small irony in the fact that your parents left the Soviet Union to give you a life free from this kind of ideological oppression and suppression of your free speech.
Yeah, that's why I'm sensitive to this. That's why I've sort of devoted my life to promoting liberty and the rule of law and studying the Constitution. You know, the American Constitution remains the most brilliant political document, organization of a country document that we've seen. During this process, I started rereading Solzhenitsyn, and he said, "Live not by lies, let the lie triumph, but not through me." And that became my mantra.
FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, they put out a report called Scholars Under Fire that explored cancel culture in colleges and universities across the country. It found 1,080 scholar sanction attempts, skyrocketing from a grand total of 4 in the year 2000 to 145 by 2022, with the vast majority of those attempts coming from the left. And Georgetown was one of the top schools with cancellation attempts.
Yeah, they gave Georgetown a Lifetime Achievement Award for violating speech.
Yes. There's a dubious honor for sure. Law professors were targeted more than any other discipline. Why do you think that is? Is it because humanities departments, for example, are already pretty much ideologically conquered, or because the law and the Constitution are such strategic targets for advancing social justice? Why the focus on law professors?
Well, the people making the allegations tend to be students, and law students are very activist, and they want to use these legal tools that they're learning about and make a case about everything. And I think a lot of them do come to law school thinking they're going to rework all of the institutions, tear them down, rebuild them in various ways. They're sensitively attuned to microaggressions and these other things. I'm not saying all of them are even a majority, but this vocal minority that one of the problems, as I describe in my book Lawless, is that university leaders, law school deans included, who themselves are not generally woke radicals, but they kowtow to, they placate to this illiberal left.
And as you note in your book, law schools used to teach students how to think critically, how to argue logically, and how to respect their opponents. But now those students, and again, maybe not even a majority of them, but those students cannot tolerate disagreement. They reject the very validity of the law. They treat their opponents not with civility, but target them for personal destruction. What kind of a judicial system can we expect in the future if it's being built not on adherence to the law and respect for legal precedent, but on social justice imperatives?
That's why this is so worrisome. It's one thing if an English or sociology department goes off the rails. That's unfortunate for the development of human knowledge and what have you, but law schools train the next generation of the gatekeepers of our legal and political institutions. And so if they believe that truth is relative and your rights and freedoms depend on where you are in a privilege hierarchy, whether you're part of a class deemed oppressed or oppressed, that all institutions are illegitimate and need to be reworked according to some intersectional matrix or what have you, that's a huge problem. That threatens, that's not just kind of the age-old battles of left versus right over policy. That threatens the pillars on which American liberty, equality, prosperity stand.
And you have a chapter in your book which asserts that the problem isn't just ideology, but bureaucracy. Could you elaborate on that?
Absolutely. And I was going to say, when you're talking about the students, it's not just about the students. It's the failure of leadership. It's the failure of these law schools to do, in many cases, remedial education about respecting civil discourse, especially in a law school context. To be a successful lawyer, you have to understand all sides of a given issue, even ones you disagree with or might find offensive. You might need to argue in ways to persuade judges, an interpretive method of the Constitution or statutes that you might not like but might be effective for your client. client, and the law schools simply are failing to do those sorts of things. But getting again deeper into the less sexy topic of bureaucracy, not just ideology, non-teaching staffs have exploded in the last 20 and especially 10 years. And these bureaucrats, these educrats, educational bureaucrats, are even more radical, more left-wing than professors. And they're not steeped in norms of academic freedom or scholarship or any of that. They're pushing indoctrination in assorted ways, whether it's through orientations, whether it's trainings. They are allowed to imbue this illiberal culture, in part because faculty don't want to bother with dealing with that stuff. They said, oh yeah, we'll just hire some folks to take care of those things so we can just do our research and our teaching. And in part because university leaders are themselves afraid that if they go against this, these illiberal actors, that they themselves will be caught in complaints and being investigated and what have you. So this relationship between ideology, the growing bureaucracy, and then weak leadership really has gotten us on a vicious cycle.
And are we already seeing examples in the real world of ways in which justice is being perverted by this kind of emphasis on social justice in law schools? In other words, are we already seeing that playing out in courts around the country?
We do see. I mean, it's more at the state level than at the federal level so far. You do have wacky rulings of, sentences depending on that are different for the same types of crimes, the same criminal record, depending on people's ethnicity or other such categories. You have law firm partners being fired for having for even winning Supreme Court cases that are deemed politically incorrect. You have law firm associates demanding that the firm leaderships act in certain ways, and there are certainly signs in the legal profession of this that it's escaped academia, that it has real world effects.
Just an overview of a couple of other ways in which the perversion of higher education has subverted or is in the process of subverting our freedoms. Like, for example, the teaching of critical theory, for example. How does a focus on critical theory in law schools impact interpretations of the law?
Well, there's nothing wrong with having a class on critical theory. This is the idea that institutions are irrevocably imbued with power imbalances, whether it's based on race or sex or privilege of various kinds. And so when lawyers, when judges when legislators are looking at how to interpret the law, craft new laws, build institutions, they have to take these into account and rebuild them on principles of equity, that sometimes people should be treated differently depending on their race because of historical imbalances, things like that. That is a perspective that has some adherence and people should be taught, but it can't be the whole of the law, because that goes against basic principles of American constitutionalism, basic classical liberal values like free speech, due process, equality under the law. I mean, critical theory holds that equality under the law is a farce, that it's a white supremacist trope. These are dangerous things.
You got a chapter in your book called A Culture of Free Speech and Intellectual Diversity Doesn't Happen by Itself. What does it take, what will it take for us to reclaim that kind of culture, as opposed to one that is obsessed with the very shallow diversity of skin color and sexual orientation?
Yeah, you know, university officials, deans, presidents, are very good at instilling whatever culture they want. Public service, social justice, entrepreneurship, whatever it is. And they have to do that for open inquiry, for respecting differences of opinion, for modeling civil discourse. But I don't think it can be done, reforms can be done just by arguing to them from within. We need external pressures and what economists would call exogenous shocks. So that ranges from state legislatures and attorneys general getting involved for public schools to employers deciding that, you know, if a school isn't teaching useful things or they have too many students who support Hamas or who yell at federal judges that they hope their daughters are raped, that's something wrong with those schools. And, you know, indeed, the managing partners of the AmLaw 200, the biggest firms in the country, ended up writing a letter to law school deans in the wake of October 7th when they were saying weird things, sympathy for terrorists and murderers, saying what kind of an outfit are you running? This is not appropriate. We can't trust these people with our clients. It'll take federal investigations. You know, we've seen that. And you know, I think the Trump administration has made some tactical errors in how it's approached Harvard and certain other schools. But there are investigations that have been launched, and civil rights violations have to be taken seriously, whether that's with respect to allowing anti-Semitism to flourish, whether it's denying speech rights, whether it's hiring based on race and sex, whether it's running your admissions office in violation of the Supreme Court ruling that prohibits racial preferences. So there's, you know, lots of things that need to be done. And sunlight shone on these illiberal practices. You know, a lot of these deans, these university presidents, what they fear most is bad PR. And just one op-ed in the Wall Street Journal causes rethinks. Or that series of hearings in the House Education Committee that we've seen of university presidents, that's had a lot of impact. So it's not something that can be done overnight. It's not, you know, some institutions will fail, but savvy educational leaders will know how to respond and improve their institutions.
You mentioned a moment ago that you felt like Trump had made a couple of tactical errors in dealing with schools like Harvard. Could you talk to that a little bit?
So the Title VI of the Civil Rights Act requires universities, if they're aware of a blocking of access to educational programs or facilities or disruptions, to take steps to remedy that. And a lot of schools have not done that in a variety of contexts. So the administration has been making demands of these schools, sending letters. Notably, Columbia came up with some sort of deal, some sort of agreement. Harvard did not. They decided to sue instead. I think it would have been a lot more effective to conclude the ongoing investigations. It would take a few months. It's not a very long time thing, but conclude your investigations, then have you know, a list of charges, things that are wrong, and say, look, what is the plan to fix this? Because otherwise you're going to lose your funding. That is what the statute requires. And so instead, the administration finds itself tied up in court because it didn't follow the legal niceties. It didn't cross its T's and dot its I's.
In the Trump era, we're starting to see some DEI programs being rolled back. Are you optimistic that this will snowball and begin to loosen this grip that social justice ideologues have on academia, or do you think universities are just going to dig in their heels?
It'll vary depending on the school. Some institutions are indeed making a good faith effort, you know, to restructure their to get rid of the DEI programming, restructure their orientations, things like that. Others, it's very cosmetic. You take down the website, you give the DEI officials different titles, and nothing, not much changes on the ground. So it's going to be a labor-intensive effort of investigation and litigation to find out which schools are complying and which are not.
And what about for the average person, the quote-unquote average person in America? It's kind of difficult to move the needle of the culture unless you, say, own a movie studio or a cable TV channel. What can the average person in America do to take some kind of concrete steps to foster the kind of culture that you're talking about reclaiming?
Well, people are sending their kids to college. And you have to be thoughtful about where you're sending your kid. It's not, don't just go by the U.S. news rankings or kind of what you perceive to be prestigious. Studies show that if someone is good enough to get into some of these more prestigious or more exclusive schools, they're going to be fine wherever they end up going. So, my advice right now is it's a healthier environment. In a more educational environment to go to, say, an honors college of a flagship state school, especially in the South, in the Southeastern Football Conference, or some schools have developed these institutes within the university. Arizona State, UNC, Florida State have developed these civics or excellence or classics based. A training program. So you really have to do your research and not just blindly follow the herd. And that we've seen evidence that that's happening. The applications to the so-called elite Northeastern schools are down, and they're up at other places. University of Florida is starting to have more applicants, more a shift towards them rather than University of Michigan to compare to large public schools, for example. So it's not going to happen overnight. But if we have a hope for changing some of these institutions and changing how our young people get educated, then it'll take a lot of conscientiousness rather than just following the herd.
Ilya, you mentioned that you were a Supreme Court watcher. I think a lot of conservatives had high hopes about judges that would be appointed under Donald Trump, but it looks like they're getting kind of a mixed reviews at best from conservatives these days. What is your take on the Supreme Court's current successes or lack thereof under Trump?
Well, overall, I think judicial appointments are the most significant legacy that the first Trump term had. 54 circuit judges, 3 Supreme Court justices, where Obama in 2 terms had fewer, for example. And these are people that are intellectually rigorous and serious and have really been influential. And at the Supreme Court level, we've seen everything from a reinvigoration of the Second Amendment, overturning of racial preferences in higher ed, overturning Roe versus Wade, pushing back on the administrative state, overturning so-called Chevron deference, the deference that judges used to owe to bureaucrats, to administrative agencies. So I think it's been very strong. Now, there are certainly, just yesterday as we're recording this, there was a big decision on upholding Tennessee's ability, and about half the states have these laws banning surgical and medical treatments for sex changes, for gender dysphoria, for minors, which is a major win. Now, there are complaints about procedural skirmishes, certain things that the Trump administration has been doing, whether it's on immigration or DOGE or certain other things that have been unorthodox, have gotten bogged down in the courts. And some of these things have gotten to the Supreme Court, and the administration has won some. They've been blocked on others. But this narrative, this frustration, I think it's overblown. You look at the totality of what's going on, and President Trump himself lashed out at the Federalist Society, but look, this is a debate within the Federalist Society. You're not going to have people who are appointed who don't come with the same rigorous credentials and experiences And we're debating things at the margins. But I think this is really there's very little impact that a president typically has, certainly in the domestic sphere, than the appointment of judges. And even though the process this time around might be a little different than it was in the first term, different kind of pool of candidates, perhaps. I think we'll see, very strong originalists who are going to be applying the Constitution faithfully.
Interesting. Ilya, where should people go online to keep up with what you're thinking and working on?
So I work for the Manhattan Institute. The website is manhattan.institute. You can find all my writings there. I'm also on X or Twitter, at iShapiro, and I have a Substack newsletter called Shapiro's Gavel. So those are some good places.
Yeah, good to know. Ilya Shapiro, thanks for joining us at The Right Take today. Keep up the important work.
My pleasure. Thanks very much.
And thank you, listeners, for joining us. Don't forget to pick up a copy of Ilya's book, Lawless, The Miseducation of America's Elites. As I said, I'm reading it now, and it's really riveting and essential reading. And don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take if you haven't already. And if you like what you hear, please leave that positive review. Be seeing you. The Right Take with Mark Tapson is a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center and Front Page Magazine. Unauthorized reproduction of this podcast without express written consent is prohibited.